You're listening to an Irreverent Podcast. Visit Irreverent FM for more content from our friends.
The B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for who? Who is this fool?
To the state that I am, God has not given us the spirit of fear.
Fear not. Be not afraid. Let's add and take away. Till that's the book for me.
Hello, hello. I am Janice Legata, and I'm just a black ex-evangelical girl standing in front of a white evangelical world asking it to burn down. The Bible says that God has not given us the spirit of fear, but I got mine from somewhere, and I am mad about it. So if you're under the sound of my voice, it means it's about time to get a little revangelical. So welcome to God Has Not Given. Folks, friends, and allies, welcome back, and welcome, if it's your first time. It is April, and welcome back to me. Look, March came and went, and I don't know. I just could not gather myself to get the podcast together. I had a list of people to reach out to have on, and I just really got in my own head and just could not get out. But then, in a deconstruction drama turn of events, I was confronted with the audacity of a white man who offered to introduce me to somebody I already knew. And I just had this moment, well, I had several moments of several things, but I had this moment of realizing that this person has no idea of who I am. And not in like a Carl Lentz passel, you should know who I am kind of way, but well, maybe a little bit. There was just something about somebody breezing into this space and feeling like they not only deserve to be taking up space, but that they had the right to decide who else could. And he was willing to allow me to. Like, I just got here, and I was so annoyed with them and then with me, because the issue was not them not knowing who I am. It's that I had forgotten, and I had started buying into the algorithm's low estimation of me, and I already have a hard time taking myself seriously in the sense that the things that I'm good at, I tend to think are, like, nothing special, because if I can do it, then probably anybody can. And so I do things, and then I almost immediately devalue them. But then watching other people do much less and get much more. Well, if you haven't listened to the latest episode of TNE Talks on the New Evangelicals podcast, Ashley, Tim, and I talk much more in depth about social media, platform culture, and the drama and the algorithm. So I'd say go listen to that to hear more about what had happened and how I have arrived at this new level of realization that I am good at what I do and that the things that I do are worth something, regardless of what the algorithm thinks. And also that there is this new generation of deconstructionists out there who haven't seen some of what I've done. And so sometime in the next week or so, I'm going to release a new edit of Heart for This House, my long-form sketch masterpiece, to remind those who have forgotten, myself included, of a little bit of what I'm capable of. So, long story short, too long didn't read. I got into my own head, got in my own way, tarried there for a while, but then finally dragged myself out, pressed send on some emails, and was thankfully rewarded with people saying yes. Really great people, including this episode's guest. I first came to know of Trey Ferguson via Twitter. He's got a quick wit and is a wordsmith, and so I both respected and feared him as a Twitter assassin, right? Like, I loved watching him work and prayed to God I would never be in his sights. So when I found out he was writing a book, I assumed it would be good, and I was not wrong. Theologizing Bigger is the name, and expanding on theology is the game, so it was right up my alley, and I legit enjoyed it. It's definitely more Christian than I am, but that's the beautiful thing about deconstruction. We all land in different places, and that is A-okay. I genuinely enjoyed the book and this conversation with Trey, and I hope you'll enjoy listening. So, without further ado, let's get into it.
I'm Trey Ferguson, and I can be found on just about any social media platform at PastorTrey05. That's PastorTrey05. And a lot of people think that that is about me wanting to or needing to be identified as a clergy person, as a pastor. What is missed by most people is that it is a play on Pastor Troy, the crunk rapper from Atlanta. Before I was seriously involved in ministry, that was my handle, because I just thought it was funny. Like, it's Pastor Troy, and then it was Pastor Trey. But I also live in Miami-Dade County, the 305 area called Trey-05, and it just kind of flowed. Like, it was cool, and it helped. Anytime I hop on a new platform, I just kept the same handle. Eventually, I got involved in ministry, and it made sense. When I was looking for a website, TreyFerguson.com was bought. Whoever did that, you a sucker, by the way. You're not even using it. Come up off that when you're ready. But TreyFerguson.com was unavailable. Don't go there, by the way. I keep saying it. Don't go there, because we don't want to encourage that nonsense. And PastorTrey05.com was available. So that's how that ended up just being the thing we stuck with.
How funny, how random would it be if the person who does have TreyFerguson.com just happens to listen to this podcast and is like, oh, dang, I forgot I had that.
You know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. So I'm actually counting on that being the case. I'm counting on them tuning in right now, whether it's a Holy Spirit download. It might just, I don't know how it happens, but I need you to know I want to appreciate how you move in this world. I actually scouted out the day that the registration was set to expire so that I could buy it one day, but they had it on auto renewal.
So we're going to trust and believe, right? We're two or more gathered. We can make this happen. So
nothing lasts forever. So one day I'm gonna look and it's gonna be available and it's gonna be mine. Except now that I said it on this podcast, somebody's gonna know, like, there's a hater out there who's gonna scoop it up and they're gonna try to extort me. And the problem with that line of thinking is there's nothing in the world I want that badly. Like, you can have it. I'm just gonna pray in precatory songs against you and everyone you love. Until you do right by me, as Silly from The Color Purple said.
All right. It's time to learn a little more about this episode's guest via 10 random choices. The game is this or that, and it really is that simple. The only rule, death is not an option. Unless, of course, death is an option. And in that case...
then, of course, the choice is yours.
You can deal with this, or you can deal with that.
Ginger ale or Sprite?
Ginger ale.
Elephant or giraffe?
Giraffe.
Mm-hmm. Swimming pool or lake?
Swimming pool. The lakes are where the animals live at. It's daytime. I don't break into somebody else's house, huh?
All right, let's see if this logic holds. Bottom of the ocean or deep space?
Let's go with deep space. I mean, I'm going to die either way. I'd rather die in like a more novel way, I guess, you know? Like, I don't know.
Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings?
Game of Thrones. I've never watched any of the Lord of the Rings entries all the way through. See, the thing about Game of Thrones is I could turn it on and know that somewhere within the span of an hour or so it had to end. Lord of the Rings does not operate by that same ethic, you understand? And the way my attention span is set up, I'm going to just have to take y'all word for it. I've heard things about it. Some of them got to be true.
Nintendo or PlayStation?
Ooh. I'm a go Nintendo just for nostalgia's sake. Like, they got a longer track record. They was trailblazers in this thing, you know.
Mac or PC?
Mac. I got caught up in the ecosystem over here, and I can't get out now. Like, I'm not saying this with a smile on my face. It's just I'm trapped, you know. Like, whatever Jesus did to affect our salvation, it didn't save me from this particular stronghold.
That's real. That's a little too real. I'll have to say law on that. Kendrick or Drake?
Kendrick.
And finally, TikTok or Twitter?
Okay. I don't know how to answer this one. But the simple fact that, I mean, the obvious choice for me seems to be Twitter, because that's where I, like, stake my whole thing out. However, the Twitter that I came up with is not the same Twitter that people are experiencing today. I'm still never going to call it by that letter, but it's clearly a very different experience. And I've never really cracked the code on TikTok. So I guess I'll stick with the hand that fed me. Let's go with Twitter.
Yeah, how is Twitter these days?
It's real ghetto. So the way I'll put it, right, like, I lived in a gated community, which I have mixed feelings about, right? But the thing about it is it was a condo community, meaning that everybody in there owned something, right? There was pride of value in it and stuff like that. And every now and then an owner would rent out to somebody. Mm-hmm. And then eventually a bunch of investors came in, and to the point where like nobody who lives in there actually owns anything anymore. They rent, and all of the prices are too much for what you're getting, because at this point it's resetting the market and all sorts of things. And in a neighborhood that was really cool and beautiful once upon a time became something that was less than, because some people got greedy. And that's what happened to Twitter, right? Nobody who has any ownership or pride in what the actual product is can't afford to be there without great cost to their mental health and wellness. And so all that's left is like kind of depressing.
Do you think, is there hope for it? Or is that like, we're in the end days of so many things. Is Twitter one of the apocalyptic happenings?
Yeah, that's interesting to see, because the way that this has worked out historically is that all of the social media platforms have a shelf life. And I'm not just talking about like microblogging, whether we're talking about actual blogs or Zanga, MySpace, Black Planet, they tend to have a shelf life. The one that seems to have the most legs behind it is Facebook and by extension Instagram and everything, because they found a way to turn it into like its own universe or whatever. Mm-hmm. Twitter never reached that exact level, but it was embedded enough within community, like tweets and stuff like those words have entered the vernacular in a way that like, oh, maybe this could be another one of those things that doesn't have a shelf life. Until the spaceman came along and took a sledgehammer to all of that. Like, oh, I'm going to change the name. Like, whoa, no, that was the strongest thing it had going for it, you know? And so we might see it transitioning into that, the great beyond, where we got the graveyard where MySpace and Zanga and all those other places live. And Black, it's a segregated graveyard, though. So Black Planet is in another one.
Yeah. Have you tried out any of the Twitter alternates, the new kids on the block?
I'm on Threads. I have a Blue Sky account. I don't really use it that often because I went over there. I was like, oh, there's no Black people over here. This is making me uncomfortable. So I went back. I'm on Threads. The integration with Instagram and all that stuff was simple enough. I didn't feel like there was a lot of learning curve there.
So
that's where you'll find me for the most part.
All right. So you are... I think you occupy a very interesting space in Christianity, evangelicalism. I think you're like right in the middle, because you are Pastor Trey. You are theologizing bigger, but you're still theologizing. So my usual question is, well, complete this sentence. Deconstruction is not enough. I need to fight. Fill in the blank. But for you, I'm going to switch it up a little. So theologizing bigger is not enough. I need to fight. Who or what?
Jerry Falwell Sr. And God bless the dead and all that. But now send him back. I got stuff to say. Like, come outside. We not gonna jump you. Just the way that this whole thing transpired. I'm a student not only of Christianity, but of religion in general, how it functions as a sociological representation of the significance we're ascribing to stories and symbols. And I'm also a student of American history, and recognizing the way that a political movement was cloaked in the language of religiosity, Christian piety, and everything, and the degree to which that has become the norm in not only American politics, but in our faith and religious discourse, if you're listening to certain people, which we don't have to, by the way. We can ignore a lot of people and be better off for it. But he is a great avatar for that shift in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. And I would like to have some words.
Yeah. It's strange just what an outsized influence he had and that his life had. And like, he's very public. So in a way, people know his name. And people are like, oh, okay, yeah, Jerry Falwell. Yeah, of course. And you know, it might mostly know him for some of his more extreme stances, but might not realize how much he was doing behind the scenes and how much all of our lives have been affected by that. Like, we're living in the wake of Roe v. Wade being overturned right now. And that was like one of his signature pieces.
And, you know, people not realizing that that had nothing to do with the sanctity of life and anything else, you know, and it's just stupid stuff. This is about desegregating schools.
Yes.
People not wanting to, like, have their tax benefits taken away.
Right.
And it's just crazy that that happened. A lot of that happened in our lifetime. So it's not even like it's ancient history.
Right.
And he's like, oh, no wonder we lost the thread of what happened. It's like, no, this was right in front of us.
Yeah, right in front of us the whole time. And it's funny because if you pay close enough attention, people will often, whether intentionally or by accident, telegraph their moves. And so one of the things that a lot of people will accuse me of is living in an echo chamber. And I'm like, no, I'm actually very familiar with a lot of different viewpoints. I don't broadcast a lot of them because I don't think some of this stuff needs amplifying. But that's one of those projecting things, right? Because one of the things that Jerry Falwell Sr. was very great at doing is creating literal echo chambers, right? Like Liberty University exists as a bastion for more conservative bankers. Right? And you see that a lot on the right, where Fox News exists because Rupert Murdoch saw a vacuum, like, oh man, if I could take all of these grievances from middle-class white people and everything and channel them right here. Like, no, building echo chambers of thoughts and ideologies is how we have this whole conservative ecosystem of the moral majority and all of you, like literally creating actual universities and institutions as bastions of quote unquote conservative thought. Yeah, so when people accuse me of being in an echo chamber, I'm like, oh, no, you're assuming that because that's how you operate. I'm doing the same thing on the other side. Beloved, that's not how this works.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot. Ooh, so much projection going on in so many ways these days. And a lot of it, unfortunately, uses the Bible, uses Christianity to get its points across and to get people into the chambers and to, you know, feed them what's in there. So I personally am definitely ex-evangelical, have definitely deconstructed. At this point, I don't mind the Bible. I think it's fine. I enjoy bits and pieces of it. I know too much to ever unknow what I know. And so at this point now, I like it because a lot of it doesn't make sense. And evangelicals, just the way they're wired and the way they're taught to think, you know, they just disassociate from the dissonance. They just lean into it. So it's really easy to trip them up at the end of the day if you know.
It'll look like tripping up to you and many people who are trying to view things objectively. I don't think many of them will feel as though they've been tripped up for the simple fact that when we are wed to a particular narrative or way of seeing things, we have a way of blocking out like the things that would detract from that. I think the clearest way I've seen that presented is factual truth versus practical truth. And practical truth are the narratives that we choose to accept and live by. And at the end of the day, those practical truths will always outweigh the factual truths that we come across when we're evaluating which way to head in any given direction. And that's for all of us. I think we're all vulnerable to those biases and things that most often manifest as confirmation bias.
Yeah. 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 So before we get into the primary question and the primary discussion point of what you would take away from the Bible and or Christianity, tell us a little bit about Theologizing Bigger. Why this book? Why this time? What brought it about? And how is it? How's it going? How are you feeling about things?
Yeah, those are great questions. So Theologizing Bigger is largely a letter I wrote to a younger version of myself and felt compelled to share it with the world, right? I grew up in the church, and it's important for me to name that I don't really identify as ex-evangelical for the fact that I've never really identified as an evangelical, right? I grew up in the Black church where a lot of, I guess, the Bevington quadrilateral is fulfilled. We would technically be qualified as evangelical by some of those metrics, but most Black people in the Black church aren't thinking of themselves by that label or that metric. And so even as I continually evaluate my faith, which is something that I've always carried with me, I've never felt the need to distance myself from a tradition that I didn't feel I belonged to in the first place. With that said, like I said, I always carry this examination of what I believed and why. And some of that is because of what I inherited from my parents. You know, my dad, revolutionary type dude, wasn't like, he worked with the Black Panthers. He wasn't a Black Panther. He was a young lord, right? The Puerto Rican version, even though my dad was Jamaican. It's confusing. But it's a guy who questioned a lot of ways of being and a lot of systems, things of that nature. My mother came to the Christian faith later in life. And so it wasn't as though I was steeped in indoctrination by people who were raised in certain systems. No, I was introduced to this by things. I was introduced to this by inquisitive people and things of that nature. And so I wasn't really met with, when I had questions, I wasn't met with, oh, like, so you just got to trust God in this. It was like, no, let's work some of these things out, right? And so as I reflect on things like love the Lord with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength, all those things, that mind part, I don't ever leave that part out. But as I continue to grow into certain communities, and when I started getting serious about ministry and undergoing the process of formal theological education, I was introduced to people who didn't necessarily appreciate that level of inquisitiveness. And that was kind of jarring to me because, yeah, I've heard people like, oh, yeah, we just got to trust God and everything. But they never made me feel like I was out of whack. It wasn't until I got into the corridors of academia, right? Some of the more conservative spaces of academia, rather, where people made me feel as though I was somehow deficient because I made full room for all of my questions and everything. And what I realized was the God that was being presented to me in these spaces where I was supposed to be getting formal training to be able to help other people grow in their faith, the God that was presented to me in those spaces was too small, right? And I dropped out of seminary the first time because I was like, oh, I'm wasting my time here. I came in here and the God I'm leaving with is smaller than the God I came in with. And I eventually did go back to seminary, got a bit of a mainline education at the second stop, or more mainline education. And for that reason, I don't regret the path I chose at all because I'm able to understand and parse arguments and perspectives from across the theological spectrum at this point. But after having done all that and serving in a local church context, as I still do, I recognize there are a lot of people who have to construct these barriers between what it is they claim to believe and the lives they have to live on a regular basis. Theologizing vigor is a way of reintegrating your faith with your life. It's about believing that when this transcendent, incorruptible, immortal God puts on finitude in the person of Jesus, that is a shattering of the barriers that we think of between the sacred and the secular, right? Between the profane and the transcendent, all of these things. And so I wrote a book with little nuggets that a younger me who was struggling with those things might have appreciated. And I've found that, like, even though I'm real Black and as a part of my story, I found that some of these things connect with people who've experienced life much differently than I have, because there's a certain universality around struggling with making this faith we've inherited connect with the lives that we live.
Yeah. Reading your book is such a good book, but it was challenging for me because I was like, oh, like, it's making me nostalgic for something I never had. Because I grew up in the church. I grew up under a Black woman pastor primarily, but it wasn't a Black church.
Yeah.
It was very, they'd come out of the Assemblies of God.
Yeah.
And it was very white evangelical, like, you know, Kenneth Copeland was like,
yeah,
spiritual father there. And so, like, it, I don't know, it just made me kind of sad because I'm like, I feel like I missed out on something. And again, this is all very recent history. And so, like, it's just funny to me, like, just how quickly that divide happened. Like, there were Black people in general, like, stayed in the faith, like, stayed in Christianity. But some people stayed in Black Christianity, yeah, in the Black faith, and then some went the other way. So you would think, like, oh, you were from a Black church, and you and Trey would have the same kind of experience, and we did not.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to speak with the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss from Trinity out in Chicago. And the way that he frames it, he says there are Black churches and then there are churches with Black people. They're not the same. And that's not like commenting on the quality of the characters, there is a uniquely and distinctly Black theology and a Black way of approaching these things and holding these stories and how we tell this story that is a bit divergent. And it's not to say it's deficient or any, it's just different. It's the way it goes, right? There are lots of churches with exclusively Black people, and there's not a single difference in the way that these stories are told. You won't notice a single difference in the theology between you walking into Kenneth Copeland's church or somebody else's church. And then there are churches like, and I think back in 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president and the Jeremiah Wright clip starts hitting the internet, I'm like, oh, not God bless America, God damn America. A lot of us heard that and was like, what's wrong with that? Like, that's normal for us. But the fact that there were so many people who were ignorant of the fact that, oh, this is how a lot of people approach their faith on a regular basis, right? Like, my church meets in school. And one of the things I do on a regular basis, the school has an American flag there because I say the Pledge of Allegiance. Oh, I'm moving that. That doesn't belong in my place of worship, the way I approach. And there are other people, no, it's perfectly normal to have a flag in the sanctuary or in the church somewhere. And it's just different ways of approaching this thing and how we hold these stories of Jesus and what we believe that Jesus is communicating to us about the lives that we live. And I think there's a degree to which, and yeah, I have opinions about it. At the same time, I don't judge anybody who is in a Black church that espouses theology that is consistent with that of conservative white evangelicals. We inherit what we do, you know?
Right. Yeah. Cause they don't know. They don't know. Like, I didn't know, like, even, you know, just thinking about something as simple as the flag, like, was the flag in your church? The flag was in my church, but like, it was never, had it not been there one Sunday, I don't think I would have noticed. Like, it wouldn't have been like a thing, but I also didn't notice that it was there, right?
Yeah.
So it's just, yeah, like, you don't know. You don't know that you're not in a church that is teaching Black liberation theology. Like, you don't even know that that is a thing because you're not there and you're not hearing it. So it's just very interesting. And then especially, you know, when you're coming, ending up in places like Hillsong and these mega church structures where they are trying to fulfill their DEI quotients, right? And so they're pulling people.
Yeah.
But then they're pulling people with the theology that they want, the look that they need and the theology that they want. And so it's like, oh, this divide gets even deeper. It just gets sad because then you see people who are rising and the people who are being put up. And then once you see it, you can't unsee it. And you're like, oh, I know why they're there. Why?
Yeah. It's a lot of Republican marriages going on in the evangelical space. I joke about it. It makes some people uncomfortable, but I'm like, hey man, like, I get it. It's tight, but is it right? Like, do you see what I'm saying here? Can we check the stats on this? You know, and I don't have a lot of room to talk. Some people think I'm in a Republican marriage myself. I'm like, no, my wife's parents are in a Republican marriage, and that's her skin reflects that. You don't know what a Republican marriage is. You'll get it on the way home. It's fine.
Oh, man. All right. So that's church life. That's the beginnings of theologizing bigger. But let's take it from my point of view now. So Bible, Christianity, if you had to take something away from the Bible and or Christianity, so what would it be and why?
So if I were to start with the Bible, I don't know if I would remove it. I would definitely move Revelation. For the fact that just with it being a conclusion of the set of books that contains the least amount of material like that, right? Like, we have some apocalyptic literature, the book of Daniel, and it pops up in some of the prophets. Like, Ezekiel has some weird stuff going on, but for the most part, within the New Testament part of the canon, like, we got stories about Jesus, and then we got a bunch of letters written by some of Jesus' followers to encourage people, and a Revelation, which is presented as a letter, but then starts talking about all this crazy stuff and all of these wild visions, right? And now we got people trying to equate Apache helicopters with the locusts that are coming in and all these things. I'm like, oh, that's not really necessary. We don't got to do all that. You're doing a whole lot, right? Do you really think as though John the Revelator was sitting on the Isle of Patmos in the first century or the second century, depending on when you date this particular letter, and dreaming up helicopters like Leonardo da Vinci? Is that what we believe is happening right here, or is something else being communicated about what it looks like to follow Jesus in the uncertain times of the Roman Empire and what this looks like for people who cannot find acceptance, right? And I think that this leads to a whole lot of not only misinterpretation, but a lot of franticness and fanaticism that does not serve us well in terms of looking more like Jesus, who was in his own right an apocalyptic prophet, and he did speak a lot about what things would look like in the end times. And he did even use some imagery, right? Like when he talks about what Judgment Day will look like, separating sheep from goats and everything. But that's a lot different than multi-headed dragons emerging from the sea and all these other things, and this cosmic woman, pregnant woman giving birth to a baby that a dragon is ready to devour. And these are powerful images. They're good and everything. But that leads me to what I wish we could remove from Christianity, because when we give these type of images to a people who are wired a certain way, it leads to a great deal of harm. And what I wish we could remove from Christianity is this quest for and the premium that we put on the idea of certainty, right? The idea that there is an interpretation that is God-given and God-inspired, where that's not even a claim that the Bible makes of itself, right? We say that, oh, this is inerrant and everything, when a lot of times we talk about inerrancy, we're actually talking about an interpretation. And so we spend all of our time trying to find this right interpretation and affirm this interpretation, as opposed to affirming the image of God and people stationed around the world experiencing life differently, who are bringing different things to this text and therefore bringing other things out of the text. And it's in the community of all those different people where we get clearer images of God, right? And so this idea that certainty is something that can be attained by some people and affirmed enough to the point where one of those certainties becomes the authoritative certainty, all that does is push more people to the margins and in the process make God smaller, right? I wish that we could value speculation a little more, that we could value diversity of thought and perspective. Because it's only when we station enough people around an object, enough people who are willing to move around and bring the fullness of who they are and what they're seeing into conversation with one another, that we can get a clearer picture of what it is that we're actually looking at.
Yeah. So before leaving church, so I think in like 2016, maybe 2015 and 2016, like I read through the Bible, the whole thing. You know, like at the beginning of the year, I'm doing one of those crazy 40-day plans where you're just, you know, smashing through it.
Yeah.
And I remember getting to Revelation, and I don't know, you're just reading it so fast. I'm like, well, I'm not really lingering here. I'm not really thinking about this stuff. Like, I'm just reading it. And so getting to the end, and I remember just crying because I was like, oh, like, I don't understand anything. And I'm not really trying to, but like just that idea, because like it just ends with the idea that like it's going to be fine. Like it's going to work out.
Right.
Like whatever this chaos is, like we just know we have this hope. And so like I walked away just holding on to that and not trying to.
To be cold the whole thing.
Yeah. 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 What is the drag? Is it here?
Yeah.
Do I know him? Like,
yeah.
So I'm really like, is it something? Do you think it's something inherent to us as individuals? Is it the groups that we're in? Is it like, what is it that makes you theologize bigger, that makes me look at this stuff and not feel the need to decode it, not feel the need to make it into something? Like, why do you think it's easier for some of us to take it on, just see it differently, and also, you know what the rules are, know what the accepted interpretations are, and say, I see that, but I think something different, and I think that's okay.
I think a lot of it depends on the value that you place on belonging in your particular context, right? Based on what I know of you and your story, and feel free, tell me when I'm wrong or stepping out of line. The time frame you just described and that period, that was right around the time that you were on your way out of that space, right? And so whether or not you had named it, there was a part of you that was like, yo, I'm going to go where the truth leads me, even if it's out of this particular community, which is a decision that a lot of us make. Whether or not we are willing to name that decision, that's a shift that occurs in a lot of us. And when you are determined to follow the truth that I believe is Jesus, right? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, whatever. When you're willing to do that, sometimes you recognize that it will lead you out of community, right? There are some people who have to leave their churches to find God, right? And at the same time, there's something terrifying about leaving community, particularly as there are comforts involved there, particularly as if those are the only communities that we've known, right? There are people who've spent their entire lives around a certain church community, and that's a terrifying prospect that I actually understand in an intimate way. That fear of leaving that behind, of going into the unknown, can often be an inhibitor to following the truth or Jesus or God, wherever it may lead us. Right? It's why Abraham believed God. It was credited to him as righteousness. What Abraham does to exhibit that is leave the familiarity of home and go where God is leading. Jesus tells people all the time, like, look, you need to count the cost of what it takes to follow me. If there are certain things holding you back, you can't really follow me. And so when you say, like, what makes us able to, there is a certain posture of being curious enough to leave that takes a certain amount of either courage or weariness can also lead you to that place. When you realize that the comfort and the familiarity of home or that community is actually taxing you in a way, or is actually taking a toll. And until and unless we reach one of those points, we might catch glimpses of the truth, but we won't exert a lot of energy in following it because it can be costly in terms of the lives that we've built for ourselves.
Yeah. 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 Because thinking about it now, I'm like, oh yeah, it was a loss of community, but also kind of on the back of realizing, like, oh, I don't really fit in this community.
Right. Like,
this is not healthy for me.
Right. The thing about belonging is that belonging in certain places will cost you a lot of yourself, right? Like, you can only belong here if you check this part of yourself at the door. And for some of us, the part that we're being asked to check is a lot larger than it is for other people. So if me and a bunch of people who think exactly like me construct the boundaries of belonging around the way that we think, oh yeah, you come in here, but whatever is not like us, you're gonna have to leave out there, right? And when that occurs, it is actually healthier for those people who had to check so much of themselves to leave, right? When belonging costs you that much, it is fair to question whether or not belonging is worth it. Now, I know that sounds like heretical to some people and everything, because Jesus says to deny yourselves. But if only some people have to deny themselves, then we're not talking about belonging to Jesus' community. We're talking about belonging to your community, and your community don't really slap like that no way. You know what I'm saying? It's only in all of us having to deny ourselves equally in all these things that we're actually following Jesus. If you don't got to deny nothing, but I got to deny everything, then you're not asking me to look like Jesus. You asked me to look like you. Yeah. And you ugly. I'm sorry.
Oh, yep. No, too real. Okay, so you said you wouldn't necessarily remove it. You might move it. So if you were to move Revelation, where would you put it? And if it's not at the back of the Bible anymore, what's there? John, Jude? Jude, is that what's right before Revelation? Or would you put something else there?
I'll put something else there. I'll end the Bible with Hebrews. Something I've actually put thought into. If I were in charge of arranging a Bible, where would things go? Because, you know, these are actually things that happen. If you if you go into the Hebrew Bible, into the Tanakh, the orders of the book are actually different than they are in the Christian Bible. Right? The Tanakh ends with Chronicles, where to back it, I think. Like, Chronicles doesn't follow the book of First Kings as it does in our Bible because they're communicating different things, right? Mm-hmm. I would probably slide Revelation up to right after John. Mm-hmm. Like right after the Gospels, just because it would seem awkward at first to a lot of people, except that's where it was. And we would just think of it as right there anyway. Right. And the order of some of those books doesn't really make sense anyway. Like Acts should be coming after Luke. It's very explicitly a continuation of that narrative. But we slide it in after John. Like, yeah, we can put Revelation up there. And then somehow like its importance in that way is shifted in our mind and imagination. I would end it with Hebrews because Hebrews is actually a pretty complex teaching that is easier for us to grapple with than the terrifying images present in Revelation. Right? And Hebrews even talks about like, oh, needing to go from milk to solid food. No, it's complex. It's there. And Hebrews is, as Revelation is, in my personal opinion, often misinterpreted, what is being communicated there, and a lot of the supersessionism that comes from the way that we read those stories, it's still going to be there regardless of where we place it. But the idea that Jesus is, yes, instituting a covenant, but that is wholly other than the covenant that we read about in Levitical laws and everything is very present there. And I think that's important to understand. But the fact that Christianity is not a continuation of Judaism. It just isn't. It is largely a reinterpretation of Judaism in some ways. And the fact of the matter is, particularly now when the majority of Christians in the world have never identified as Jewish people. In the earliest stages, yes, most of the people did identify as Jewish at some point in their life, and it made sense for them to use these images and everything because that is what they knew. At this point, the only way that we come to know those things is by studying Judaism. We study a different people's culture. And so I think when we understand what Hebrews is doing, it's reinterpreting the story of a Jewish people for this new idea of a faith system and everything. It kind of gives us the freedom to view ourselves as other, which is what we are. We're not the continuation of Judaism or the continuation of that covenant. No, this is something entirely new, which that book does make clear, but for a different audience.
That's very, very interesting because I haven't thought about it in a while, but going out, Hebrews was my book. Like, and I don't even know why, but I would like just listen to, like when I was going to sleep, like it was just something about Hebrews that just...
They go really deep. Like it's a lot of real artistic stuff going on there. And if you're a creative person, you can appreciate what's going on. So the idea that Jesus is a priest, but in the order of Melchizedek, right? In Leviticus, all the priests are from the family of Aaron. It's like, no, this is a different family. It couldn't go into the, like a priest in the order of Melchizedek can't present a sacrifice in the temple because that's Aaron's job. It's like yes, there are some similarities, and if you think about that, it'll help you understand this, but this is something wholly different. And there's so much artistry going on and how that story is reinterpreted to explain something different. Like, yeah, it's kind of like that, but something else, right? And that's so beautiful. It's exciting. And like I said, particularly if you're a creative person, there's a lot of inspiration to be found there.
Yeah. You almost making me want to go look at the Bible again. All right, so... That's what we're taking away, moving, shifting around. So now if you had to add something, need you to give me two things that we're putting in there, and at least one of them has to be something of yours.
So. Okay. All right. I would add the appendix to Frederick Douglass's slave narrative to the Bible. I would. And it would be really awkward if you're not from the United States, because a lot of it is very like USA centric. I apologize, rest of the world, but I need to clean my whole house up first. We live in real ghetto over here. And I think Frederick Douglass speaks with a very clear prophetic voice in how he addresses these things when he says things like, between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference, right? It's the same. It's an echo of I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Like, no, what are you guys even doing over here? Y'all are playing around. And he really gets into it. I think that prophetic critique is very much in line with what we see of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible, what we see John the Baptist calling people to, what we see Jesus calling people to. Like, oh no, we got to do better than this. Particularly if we were claiming that we're doing this in the name of God. So I would add that there. And then if I got to add something I wrote, I would add, so I have a chapter in the book called Living in the Matrix. I would add that as an epistle in there to clarify what it is that we're talking about when we talk about sin. Because I think a lot of us are getting that picture a little distorted. And we're focused on tasks, or not tasks, we're focused on like little misdeeds and things of that nature, as though that's what Jesus came to save us from, when really sin is a lot more comprehensive than that. It's the very air that we breathe, right? And I talk about living in the Matrix because in the movie The Matrix, Morpheus has almost that exact speech. He said, oh, the Matrix is the air that you breathe. It's the thing. And when we wake up to the reality of what sin is, that it defines the way that we see the world, right? When we look at the resources around us as scarce, things that we need to compete for, and that they're going to be winners and losers, and that, no, that's all sin, right? Because even the losers in that system were created in the image of God. They're all placed in good creation that was designed to sustain all of us, because we're all connected in a certain way. And the idea, or the fact that we don't all see the world in that way, is actually a result of sin, the result of living in this matrix, right? And I frame it that way because I say that, oh, Jesus is Neo in that scenario. He's the one who's sent to bring that matrix down, to pull that back, so we can see things as God sees them, as they truly are, where we can all live here together and things could be good. It's gonna look real different, real different. But that idea of sin being how we see the world around us, and the actions and the that we take, and the ways that we show up in the world as a result of that—that's what sin is. It's not just the white lies and the stealing diapers at the grocery store. No, it's the systems that create the fact that some people need to steal diapers for their babies. Right, that's sin too.
Yeah. Ooh, Trey, I like you.
I like you too.
So we're almost done with this part, but then I'm going to keep you for another 10 or 15 minutes, because then I just do like a little, just for the Patreons, just a little bonus content.
All right.
Yeah. So I already knew that my bonus content with you was going to be, I was going to push you a little bit about something from your book.
All right, let's do it.
And it's from that chapter.
Okay.
So we'll get to that in a second, but we'll finish up this part first. So, well, before I get to my final question, do you have anything you want to add, anything you want to say, anything we didn't cover that you want the public?
No, I like this. I like where we're going. Let's keep going there.
All right. So as we finish up, the world is on fire. What is something that you would suggest everyone do, try, or see before Earth is over?
Me second here. What is something that somebody should do, try, or see before Earth is over, as the world is on fire? I was in Argentina for a couple weeks one time, right? And I was encouraged to try eating lots of different things, and that's what I did. And I ate llama, and it was surprisingly delicious. And this was the only time I've eaten llama. It's been like almost, I don't know, like 15, probably close to 20 years since that moment. So some of this might be like nostalgia speaking or whatever, but if for no other reason, even if you don't enjoy it, the fact that I get to tell people like, oh yeah, I ate llama, you know what I'm saying? So if the world is on fire, go ahead, find you a llama. It's probably already halfway done. It's best to eat it before it's like well done anyway. Just grab the closest llama you can find and eat that joint, and then come report back to the class for us.
Well, now that I've lost all my llama listeners.
Hey, man, I'm sorry, llama listeners. But your reward in heaven shall be great for that sacrifice. your llamas were delicious. I apologize, vegans. We're there for ethical reasons. God's still working on me.
And hey, no, look, the world is on fire. It's about to be over anyway.
That's what I'm saying, man. Your llama won't go make it.
And that's that, mostly. For my patrons, the friends of Jod, the Jodly and the Jod Willing, there is an additional segment which will be up tomorrow morning, where Trey and I talk a little more about his book in a section where I wish he would have theologized just a little bit bigger. So if you want to hear more from my guests, or if you just want to be supportive and help free me from capitalism's death grip, please look me up at patreon.com/JanisLagata and consider becoming a friend of Jod. You can also be a friend to me by dropping by JanisLagata.com and checking out my little shop. I just switched to a new server and I need people to test the limits, so have at it, please. And while you're wandering around the internet looking for things to find, follow, and support, Trey, let the people know where to find you.
The best place to find me, because that hater went and bought that website, we not going to big up no more, pastortrey05.com. You can find all of my social media handles over there. If you want to listen to either of the podcasts I partake in, there's Three Black Men or The New Living Translation, you can find it there. If you want to look at my newsletter, my Substack newsletter, you can find it over there as well. If you want to find out where you can buy Theologize for Bigger, you can find it on the website. PastorTrey05.com is the best place to find me.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of God Is Not Given. If it has meant anything to you, sparked anything for you, or was just a general good time, please let somebody know. Share this with a friend, leave a rating or review on the podcast app of your choice, or let me know by leaving a comment or a series of thoughtful emojis on Instagram. And until we meet again, remember, you can believe better things, and I hope that you do, because your life is yours and you should enjoy it. So take care of you, be well, and I will speak to you soon.